Accession number 10403, Rule 17.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 17. You were describing the daily routine at the Mooseburg camp. What would happen after this minimal breakfast?
Well, a minimal breakfast, we'd then go back to our huts, and we probably scrounged a lot of tins and began making equipment. We made, out of tins, we made cups to drink from because we hadn't anything beyond the bowl, which we had to use for washing in, eating Robin from all purposes. And there was one tap between about nearly 300 people. We then, everybody pooled their surplus clothing in order that we could have a fair distribution of clothing, because the winter was beginning to come on, and it was obvious to us we were in for a pretty Central European come Russian type winter, for which none of us were equipped. We then started to find means of getting heat. The stove was not working very well, but as we were always under surveillance by electric light, we considered that we could tap the source of energy. And the first thing that we made was an electric brewer. That consisted of a stick of wood through which we stuck two bits of tin that we had cut from the side of a discarded tin, and onto that we fixed two pieces of flex wire which we had stolen from somewhere, and we then made them into two electrodes, took the other end of the wire, cut it into the conduits in the side of the hut, connected them up, and switched it on so that we could put a bowl of water in the wooden, bowl that we had, and then put this immersion heater inside the bowl, and we could make hot water. And from that, we could produce water for hot water for people to drink before they went to bed, or hot water to do a bit of washing in, or some restricted use of hot water, but we got hot water. We made all instruments, we made little spoons so that we could use. We made clothing, we started to unravel old cardigans and shorts, one another to knit, and made socks, pieces like that. We looked round to see how we could have contact with other people, and then we discovered that the camp was really run by the French, the collaborateurs.
I'll come to that, but this is what you did during the morning and afternoon. What did the Germans think you were doing?
The Germans didn't come into the huts except in their roll call times and at night. Now, they didn't come in except in threes or fours, armed, because the distance between the huts and the barbed wire was so small, and there was a wooden shutters on the outside. And it was a favorite trick of the prisoners to wait for a German to walk past the door, fling the shutter open, and knock him off his feet, and probably he'll lose his front teeth. Therefore, the Germans always came in armed. They always came in numbers, and always brought their dogs.
So they didn't mind what you were doing?
They didn't think we could do anything. Everything we did, of course, was illegal. But they couldn't think we were doing it.
How did you hide evidence of what you were doing from the morning roll call search?
Well, you would put it underneath the floorboards. And we all had, by that time, started to excavate tunnels. We took the We took the, well, there weren't tunnels, there were hardy holes. They were, we had underneath each bed, we took the bedboards out of the beds, which we used for revetting the holes, and we made holes under the bed and made a sort of a hidey hole underneath and made lids covered with earth, which we put on the top, and we could hide our gear in there.
So if the Germans looked under, they'd see the earth on top of
it? Yes, it was an earth floor in many cases. But there was nothing to stop that.
So you'd be working on this all day. Would you have any period outside for exercise?
No, we were not allowed out for exercise, except I once went out merely as a funeral party for somebody who had died, out to get them buried. That was all.
So you were only allowed out to go to the latrine and to...
walk round in this little compound, which was round the hut, which was not very, very... well, I don't know how you describe it, a few yards each side the hut.
Would you walk round and round?
Or I could walk round and round and round and things like that. But...
Did you try and keep fit?
Well, food was such a problem. Cold was such a problem. Clothing was such a problem. If a man went outside in the early mornings, going down to get the hot water, he would borrow an overcoat and a jacket from the people who were inside the hut to keep warm. It was quite a problem, it was cold.
But how did you try and keep fit?
Well, it was a question of survival, of getting what food you could. You had so little. So there was no question of anybody doing exercises. You kept fit by keeping warm.
The actual running of the camp, you started to say, how was the camp structured, the running of it? You say the French collaborators, how did they fit into the system?
Well, they had a German headquarters and a German over-administration. They also had the usual section of Gestapo. The camp itself was an international camp, inasmuch that each compound housed people from every one of the occupied territories, Yugoslavs, French, Russians, anybody, people from the Low Countries, all over the place they came. And it was organized as a working camp. They had, for these workers, they used to go out every day to the fields, and they were harnessed to these wooden wagon, four-wheel wooden wagons, and they were harnessed like horses, and they were tied into these things. It would be about 15 or 16 people to a wagon, and they would haul the wagons out through the fields and over the fields, and they would load up with potatoes from the potato clumps or work in the fields and bring them in to the potato sorting and storing area. Other people would be sent out on parties doing drainage schemes and various other things. And there was a network of people being sent out from the camp and brought into the camp. All this was done under the control of the German and the Gestapo, except that the general running of the camp, administration of the camp in its lower details, were done by the French. And the French were these alleged collaborateurs. Nevertheless, they were, in fact, just as much anti-Bosch as anybody else. And whilst they gave lip service and did everything, apparently, to their instructors, from their instructors, they were doing everything they could to form organizations. And it was there that I first made contact with the French and virtually became one of them. The practice was that they brought in prisoners, Russian prisoners from the various battlefronts, and the next door to us where the Russians had come from, taken at Kiev, and had come from outer Mongolia, and were in fact virtually Eskimos in fur coats and fur hats. They spoke no known language. And they were very, very badly treated. The dogs used to be put into them. They used to be torn by the dogs. The Germans did nothing to prevent it. They had very bad food. And on one occasion, when we had a riot in the camp, they had killed a dog and eaten it and hung its skin on the wire. And the Germans came in to exact reprisals. And there was a general free-for-all all the way. But the Germans displayed themselves generally to these peoples quite ruthlessly and convinced me in my own mind that they were an evil race. They showed no compassion to these people, not one little bit, and denied them any form of hospital treatment.
Did that lead to heavy casualties amongst them?
Yes, amongst the Russians. Amongst the Russians and prisoners of those types of countries, Latvia and all that came in there. I don't think they even recorded their existence. They certainly know Russian strengths or anything given. So much was sent in and that was it. The door was slammed and the dogs put in. Not a very pleasant experience altogether.
Now, how did the French fit in?
Well, the French were, and I think it could be only the French as a nation, by reason of their general experience in the previous wars have been overrun by Germans and various other nationalities, and since the wars of 1870, they must have developed a sixth sense of being able to handle situations like this. They carried out the letters to the law, apparently. One of my jobs was to liaise with the French. And I could get out at night through the wire, which the French had fixed, that when the searchlights turned and there was a shadow caused, they pulled a bit of wire and the Dalet wire lifted up a foot, you shot underneath like a rabbit and went into the French area. And from then on, they got you behind the guard gate and into their quarters. And they were fairly well organized. They'd been there for a long time. They had a radio. Eventually we got a radio, but anyway, and every night we got the news through. We got the news through from the BBC as the true situation. And of course it was then that we learnt the proper name for the radio was the Canary, and everybody referred to it from then on as the Canary and nothing else. I then became, you might say, a bogus Frenchman, because I could be dressed as a Frenchman and do jobs in the kitchen. And then when the Germans came in, the commandant or somebody came in, I could jump to attention and smartly and say, "Morgen, Herr Kommandant, and Heil Hitler," with the best of them. But they were very good. They used to clean out all the German officers' quarters. They took all the papers out the waste paper basket. They put all the old papers so that we could read what was going on, the orders were being given. They got all the information in from working parties as to what was going on. If a German security officer got too nosy, they were not above putting his name on the bottom of the posting list, typing it on the bottom so that he got a railway warrant to Russia, for which he never came back. They really were first class in handling a situation which I don't know whether we or the British would have dealt with it so efficiently.
Now, you'd been told to liaise with them. What was the organisation of the British?
The organisation was, we got what we call the senior British officer, the SBO, and the place was organized the same as an infantry unit. You divided into companies. You had a chap who acted as adjutant and two or three acted as a staff. You then had companies and platoons and sections.
Was it an officers' camp or was this a mixed camp?
Well, this at that time was a mixed camp. This was entirely mixed. Mostly officers, but mixed, because I don't think they ever really intended to keep us there.
So you were in a company type of organisation?
We're a company type of organisation. We stuck to the military organisation.
And what was your position within that?
Well, at that time I was doing this job, as I say, as a sort of liaison, as something that I'd learnt as a POW, and I learned better after a bit that I could communicate. And I could communicate, and I used to communicate with French and be with them, and they used to cover me. And then I'd get the information back, we would get news, and then we would pass it on, and I'd get somehow or other into other compounds and pass the news on to selected compounds. We were frightened of going too near the Russians, although we did liaise with them, because we weren't quite certain as to, in the treatment they were receiving, whether they could be loyal. It wasn't a question of whether they were willing to be loyal, but could they be loyal?
You mean you were worried about giving them the...
Well, we were worried about letting them know that we had a radio. This was the worry. But we eventually established a very good organisation, and this was virtually the embryo of our later, more sophisticated. And we learnt there that the whole object of the exercise, everybody wanted to escape. But then we realised that there was such an involvement at getting people to escape and then getting into the organisation which got you through the country out, that you had to make certain that those who did escape were of value when they got back to UK. So people were rather chosen to escape and all others were discouraged. And you put your plan up to the SBO, and there was the State Committee.
Who formed the Escape Committee?
The Escape Committee were merely selected people from each company.
Were you on it?
I was not on that, because my job was externally. My job was contact with the outside through the different organisations, getting the information in.
So they'd assess each scheme, would they?
Well, you see, if you wanted to get something, you would assess each scheme. Now then, if you thought it was a good scheme, or if the Escape Committee thought it was a good scheme, there was a lot of staff work to be done. There was the uniforms or the escape equipment to be manufactured. There was the candidate had to go to school every day and not only be taught the drill, but he had to go to school to learn the information which we had of various movements coming in from various sources, so that when he got back, he was able to be of value when he got back. That was important. Then you rather selected people who could pass linguistically in some way or another, so that a man who was selected went to school every day, and if he was selected, because if he spoke French very well, he went into a room with French-speaking officers and lived with them, and they did nothing but speak that all day, and then this is the sort of thing. He was trained as an actor. He had to be. His papers were forged by the forgeries department, which we had.
How was that organised?
Well, you had officers who were very capable as artists. They could make a very passable likeness to a photograph with a lithograph thing, with doing it by pencil or by ink. We made our brushes. The way we made our brushes was that we used to catch a cat and make the brushes out some of the cat hairs. Some of the pigments, we would scrape the stemper off the wall of varying colours. You remember some of those escape maps I gave you? The colours on those were by distemper and things taken off the various walls and made into paint.
Where would you get the source material to copy?
Well, now, I'm...
Was that your job with the French, to get...
Yes, well, and then I will develop this out into our later camps, because at Moosburg we were in an embryo situation.
Right, okay, well...
And the French that I was with, they really taught us the ropes. They taught us. They had been under the German yoke for many years, several years, and they had got into the way of being able to get around the Boche somehow. And we were taught, for example, if we went anywhere, we always had to put a piece of clay in our pockets, moist clay, and if we passed anything where there was a key, we just took an imprint of the key. All these tricks were developed and were taught us by the French. They showed us how to hollow out the heels of our boots to carry things in. They showed us how to put very fine hacksaw blades around the top of our teeth to avoid interrogation. When we moved from camps, they showed how when we got radios and we got miniature valves, the various components used to be put in underneath wound dressings. The
hacksaw bit, could you just explain that a bit more?
Well, you know these little eclipse hacksaw blades thing? Well, the French had got some very small things, hacksaw, very fine teeth, of 2 or 3 inches long and very pliable. And they would just fit in around your top teeth, underneath the gum, around the front. And people would be given some of those.
And what was the purpose of them?
Well, the purpose, well, if you wanted to an area and you wanted to cut through a bit of wire, or you wanted to cut through a padlock, or you wanted to do something. There were all sorts of techniques of making skeleton keys. And we all underwent, at least I, we went under a full course of instruction to be a burglar by these chaps. And the impression I'm talking here is to try and say that it was a university of skills, of all sorts of subversive activities. They used to organize everything from blowing up bridges, as far as I can make out. And that was our, what shall we call, that was our university.
So the French could get out of the camp?
Oh, yes, the French, you see, used to go out. And they were responsible. They used to check all the potatoes, and they used to check all the supplies which came in. They were responsible for the camp, and they had complete run, because in theory they were collaborators. They had a red armband round, and they wore a kepi. And if I happened to be in the cookhouse, they loaned me a sort of a kepi and a blues blur and a pair of wooden sabots. And in that way, I could manage with my little printed document thing that they'd got for me. I was able to move past the...
How much time did you spend with them?
Oh, I don't know. It might have been a week. It might have been a month or so, or 2 months. Or not. It was quite a long time anyway. I forget what it was. Time was... It was night and day. I can't remember. However, that type of activity was going on all day and every day. We were isolated from home. We had no visits from protecting power, and we had nobody took our names, and we had no idea.
No Red Cross parcels or anything like
that? Nothing. We were all photographed and our fingerprints taken. Generally speaking, as was later manifest as well, the Germans went out of their way to really degrade us, if they could, in front of the other nationals.
How?
Well, they knew we were officers, and they would get some French in, and they would get even one or two Russians in that were going out to do some work, and they would make us carry their tools and their equipment, and tell these people that we were the scum of the earth, this sort of thing. It was a very petty and silly sort of thing, schoolboy stuff.
How did you get on with the guards? Or was there no communication with them?
There was no communication with those guards, you see. They were entirely recruited for the job. They had these dogs. They were all dogs. They had these dogs that they put in with you all the time. And they were dealing with these foreign nationals over whom they had the authority of life or death, as far as I can make out. There hadn't any, there was no sort of, even the humblest soldier could beat the daylights out of anybody without any repercussions.
Was there any actual over-the-top violence directed at people?
We found one Russian who was in the, he had been beaten and very severely beaten. And I think, and his ribs had been cracked and broke. And I think an arm had been broke. Had been thrown into the crank house, which was a sort of sick house that they had. And he'd been patched up. And after they patched him up, they just threw him back in the compound. But some fellows, some of our other acts, brought him, got him in, and got him dressed up in a British battle dress, and gave him a name and a number, and spent days teaching this wretched fellow to repeat his number, name, and rank. The practice, of course, was the snatch squads would come in with their dogs, grab a fellow and shriek at him, Namen. And as soon as that, you had to spring smartly to attention and reel off your number, name, and rank and produce an identity disc. So when this fellow was fitted up like that, he was gradually brought back to life, and we looked after him.
But beatings, severe beatings weren't common then?
Beg pardon?
Severe beatings weren't common then?
Not amongst, not not so far as we were concerned. Severe beatings to what I call recalcitrant members of the occupied territories got a good lashing up. You know, Russians got a particularly good lashing. But we weren't at that stage. We would have the odd, ridiculous reprisals.
Such as?
Well, they would put you outside in the coldest of weather. They would sometimes squirt a hosepipe over you and let you make you stand there for about 8 or 9 or 10 hours, absolutely in the freezing cold.
Why would they do that?
I don't know, just for fun. They would do this, they would allege we'd done something. They would do it, and what we used to counter was getting newspaper and rolling it up and stuffing all our clothes with balls of newspaper, so that acted as an insulator against cold. No, we insulated ourselves the best way we could with this newspaper, and then we used to make warming cups. That is, we got a tin, and we filled it up with rubbish, and we punched holes in the end, like rubbish, like bits of cord or bits of string or bits of cardboard or bits of something, and we would light this string, and it would heat this tin up, and we would whirl it round and round and round to get a glow, and then stuff it in our jacket and get some heat until the heat went out, and then we'd start again.